have one of these stories that I tell way too much. One of those stories where before I am more than a few lines in, some family member has said, I know, you told me this one. Do you have stories like that? Stories you tell over and over because they're just that good. Well, this one is mine. And if I ever try to tell you again, you can stop me and say, I know, you told me. Two monks are walking in India, someplace, and the road ends, and there's a bridge over a rough river. Except the bridge has been washed out in a storm. Now, the monks have been traveling all day long, and around the road is nothing but jungle. There's no side street you could use to get to another bridge, just impenetrable jungle all around. The monks either have to turn around and walk all the way home, and soon it will be dark, or they have to wade across the river. The water is moving really fast, but it's only about 5 feet deep. And these monks are built like linebackers. These are big monks, big, strong monks. So they can wade across, no problem. They aren't thrilled about getting soaked. They aren't thrilled about thinking about what is in that smelly water, but they can wade across. The problem is there's a woman who is also on the road. She's been about 100 yards ahead of them the entire way, and they haven't spoken to her, but she's clearly a prostitute. Now, these monks have taken a vow of chastity that involves not even touching a woman, not even shaking a woman's hand. But this woman, she's much too small to wade across, and she's standing at the edge of the river crying. She would be washed downriver before she crossed halfway over. She's so small. And so this presents a dilemma. The monks aren't supposed to touch women. No hugging, no handshakes, nothing. But if they don't help this woman, she'll turn around and take the long road home, going through a jungle after dark. And then who knows what's going to come out of that jungle. The monks confer. One says, I don't care. I have nothing to do with it. It's not my problem that the bridge washed out. Let's ignore her and just wade across and get on with it. Rolling his eyes in exasperation, the second monk sighs, and he shakes his head. He walks over to the woman. They confer briefly, and after a moment's conference, he picks her up like a linebacker would, sack of potatoes, carries her across the water. Once they are safely on the other side, but dripping wet, the monk sets the woman down and she is on her way. Soon the other monk has crossed and begins to loudly berate his friend for touching that woman. Bad enough to touch a woman, but a prostitute. Really, what were you thinking? How could you? Do your vows mean nothing to you at all? Through nightfall, the monks walk. One in stony silence while the other continues his tirade, and hours pass. And the monk's friend is still upset, red in the face and shouting about his indiscretion. Sweat beads on his forehead, the veins at his temples are popping out. And finally, the helpful monk stops in the road, sighs again, and says, my friend, I carried this woman for a few minutes across a river, but you are still carrying her. Isn't that the thing about anger? Long after the river journey, anger can continue. This week, as you know, our country lost a moral giant in the death of Pete Seeger, a folk singer and rabble-rouser and musicologist who spent decades traveling across the United States collecting varied music that he was afraid would be lost if it wasn't recorded and written down. He learned and preserved the Appalachian bluegrass that is close to my heart as an Ohioan, the English ballads that are crossbred with Irish reel dances, plus a big dose of that African-American soul. He learned the southern songs of field hands. He learned the French-inspired jazz of New Orleans. And he loved American music and all its riotous diversity, all the ways it has bloomed in our soil. But somewhere along the way, Somewhere after completing a military term, after dropping out of Harvard to play the guitar with peaceniks up in New York, Pete ran afoul of his country, or at least the House Committee on Un-American Activities thought he had run afoul. Pete was no doubt a questioner of authority, and as a young man, he looked around, as so many of us have, and he looked at the bounty of the United States, and he thought, why are some people so hungry where food molds on the store shelves? Why do some people have so much and some folks have nothing at all and live under bridges? Pete wanted greater equality, so he joined the Communist Party, a move he didn't realize would get him in so much hot water until later on. Just a few years ago, Pete said that thinking that all communists are like Stalin is like believing that all Christians are like Jesus. It's just not really how it works. Ideas get corrupted, people get corrupted. So he dropped out of the Communist Party after Stalin became powerful and after we started learning about his abuses. The blossoming of equality he had hoped for through communism died before it had flowered in the United States. So Pete Seeger moved on. He made music, he sang in churches and in schools and at protests. He hated the military inventions in Southeast Asia that were starting to germinate. But as the U.S. government became more and more concerned about communism abroad, they became more concerned about communism at home. And the House Un-American Activities Council was formed. The council had unprecedented power to overrule your right to free speech. It suspected people were harboring communist ideas, and it subpoenaed Pete in 1955. This was an insane time in U.S. history. Entertainers and activists and preachers and school teachers, librarians, politicians, they were all under this McCarthy microscope. They all were facing jail time for offenses, such as Pete, who played guitar at a communist rally, well, a rally, peace rally, co-sponsored by a communist group. When Pete Seeger went before the House Un-American Activities Council, he refused to give any information at all. You see, there was a loophole in the Un-American Activities Council. Sure, you could go to jail, but if you turned in a handful of other people, then you were off the hook. You could go about your business. But then those people were blacklisted, which meant no longer working in the entertainment industry. It meant no longer being on the radio. And for a lot of people, it meant jail time. So if you ratted out other freethinkers and you promised to change your ways, you were free to go. But fellow folk singer and actor and friend of Pete Seeger's, Bert Ives, who he'd been friends with for about 15 years, turned in Seeger's name in exchange for his own freedom. Now, Bert Ives went on to have a really successful career, but Pete refused to name names, and he was convicted of contempt, and he was sentenced to a year in prison. He said at the time, "I love my country very dearly, and I greatly resent this implication that some of the places I have sung and some of the people that I have known and some of my opinions, whether they are religious or philosophical, or that I might be a vegetarian, make me any less of an American." Every month, we think over a different theme in worship services and in small groups called chalice circles that are open to anyone, if anyone wants to join. This month, our theme is forgiveness, a multifaceted word and concept that few understand more than Pete Seeger did. See, Pete loved his country. He loved the rural woodlands of upstate New York. He loved the refined poshness of Boston when he went to Harvard. He loved the rollicking rhythms of Southern life. But his country didn't seem to love him very much, or at least the Un-American Activities Council didn't. After his conviction, Pete had a few years to appeal before his jail sentence began, so he toured hard and constantly making as much money as he could to sock away for his family for when he was in jail. So he was blacklisted, so he couldn't play the big venues, the radio stations, the big concerts that he was used to. So he played at schools and nursing homes and hospitals. He pieced together a living, visiting summer camps and teaching guitar. It was a long fall for a guy who was pretty famous before this had all started. Pete Seeger won his appeal unexpectedly, and though it took a long time to recover his career, and he probably never became as famous as he would if it hadn't happened, he always expressed relief that he didn't bow under pressure. But what about forgiveness? Pete and Burl Ives had been friends for a decade or more when Burl turned him in. Ouch! Can you imagine an old friend doing that to you? Trading your freedom for his own. He knew Pete Seeger's wife. He knew his kids. He knew that the Un-American Activities Council would, giving Pete's name to them would really hurt him, would hurt all of them, would hurt the entire family. He knew that Pete would end up in that great moral quandary. Should I protect myself and hurt other people, or should I possibly go to jail during this Red Scare? But Bert did it anyway. Michael Kublock is a fellow musician, an admirer of Pete Seeger, and a member of the Chad Mitchell Trio. He tells this story. In the 1950s, folk singer Bert Ives turned on Pete in response to questions from the House Committee on Un-American Activities. As a result, Pete was blacklisted, banned from television and radio, while Ives enjoyed a successful acting career. Though they had been good friends in the 40s and 50s, they never spoke again until a rehearsal in 1995 at the Second Street Y. We were all aware of the tension in the hall as the rehearsal time approached. Burl Ives, who was then confined to a wheelchair, was wheeled onto the stage for his sound check. Pete, who was sitting in the audience with the rest of us, rose, took his banjo, and made his way to the stage. After a quiet word with Burl, Pete gave him a hug and suggested they rehearse the couple of songs they'd sing together at the end. There wasn't a dry eye in the place. Later on that year, I was driving home, listening to NPR. This was the All Things Considered broadcast. Burl Ives had died, and they were interviewing folk singer Pete Seeger, talking about Burl Ives' life. Pete Seeger made the comment that when he thought of Burl Ives, what he remembered the most was his clear and strong voice. The interviewer wanted to probe more deeply into Seeger's thought. What about that time during the McCarty Red Scare before the House Committee? Seeger's response to the interview was, "Sometimes you just have to forgive and move on with your life." Here's the thing about forgiveness. It isn't just about the person that you're forgiving. Pete Seeger could have stayed mad at Burl Ives the rest of his life. But why let all that anger simmer in your mind? Why let it take up valuable real estate in your head? Our director of religious education, Chris Polina, and I spend a lot of time discussing what stories to tell the kids in our congregation. And so we frequently come up with this question: who are the moral exemplars who could serve as example to our kids? Who could they relate to? Not these people that lived hundreds or thousands of years ago, but people that live lives that they understand, that people who drive in cars, even people who have played video games, real people. Pete Seeger is a great moral hero of our time. He wasn't perfect, but he didn't give in to McCarty-era bullying, even when jail time was on the line. He didn't turn in his friends. And most shockingly to me, is that he forgave the man who betrayed him. He forgave Burl Ives, even though no one expected him to. This month, we will talk in great depth about forgiveness, but today I want us to think about forgiveness in a selfish way. What can forgiveness do for you? As our monks at the beginning of the story realized, anger can be a burden we carry long after it's necessary, inflicting only ourselves with its weight. As Seeger said, Sometimes you just have to forgive and move on with your life. May it be so.